Welcome back to Old Taku no Radio, where we are going to be talking about Porco Rosso. And before we do that, we've had a couple of new Patreon subscribers sign up, and we just want to give them a shout out before we dive in. Big, huge thanks to Maddie Stanley, Scott Crossan, and Nigel Brown for your support.
Oh, sure. You get the easy names to read.
I hope I didn't butcher those, but really appreciate you guys. And, absolutely check out our Patreon page for all the cool benefits you get as part of the Anti-Gamers podcasting empire, and we appreciate the support. I am Jared. I am joined, as always, by my wonderful partner, Ink.
Hello, everybody.
And like I said earlier, today we are here to talk about a film called Porco Rosso by a scrappy new young director named Hayao Miyazaki. And Ink, would you like to tell us a little bit about this film?
So this is from the back of the G-Kids release. Porco Rosso is a world-weary flying ace turned bounty hunter whose face has been transformed into that of a pig by a mysterious spell. When he infuriates a band of sky pirates with his heroics, the pirates hire Curtis, a hotshot American rival, to get rid of him. But with the help of a teenage girl, Fio, an aspiring airplane designer, and a sultry lounge singer named Gina, Porco takes to the skies for what may be his final high-flying showdown.
This film came out in 1992, and what to say about Miyazaki? Is this the first Miyazaki we've ever done on ONR?
I believe it is, yeah.
So a lot of people know Miyazaki. People outside the anime fandom universe typically are at least aware of on some level, particularly if you've got small kids, which his stuff is all like really, really great to show young kids, even though a lot of the time the subject matter is not purely for children.
This one especially, this is kind of one of the first productions by Miyazaki that was aimed a little more towards adults than children.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a very different movie from what you typically associate Miyazaki with in terms of big themes of nature and healing and renewal. And of course, the one thing that's kind of consistent is the anti-war message that you get in this film, just like you do many of the others. This is really kind of a pulp film in a lot of ways. It owes a lot to those early 20th century sort of dashing, daring, do kind of films, that star people like Errol Flynn. And I think it shares similar themes to other pulp movies and things, like say like Indiana Jones. Clearly Porco Rosso is not a treasure hunter, he's a bounty hunter actually, but it has that same sort of big adventure feel with a highly capable, somewhat tortured main character who all the ladies love him but none of them can have him, kind of that kind of guy. And it's features the machinery of war in it quite heavily. It's probably the film, other than The Wind Rises, it's probably the film that does that the most I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's a little more playful. Like, this film is thoroughly anti-fascism. It takes place in the 1920s, 1930s Italy. And that's basically when Benito Mussolini was in power, or beginning in power. And he was specifically cracking down on industry to thwart workers' rights at the time. And you see that in a couple alluded to in a couple of scenes, especially when like Porco's visiting a place to buy his guns and ammo, and there's a really great interchange and dialogue we'll talk about later there. But overall, this is actually, like you said, there's the tale of the daring do. He's a very heroic character, but he's also sort of that tortured loner. My favorite thing about this is kind of the bar scenes where he just sleeks under cover of darkness, and he's just amongst his own people, all the other air pirates and, bounty hunters. And he's just there to have a drink and listen to the songs and sort of feel human again. And that's really kind of the main character's tour de force, is he's just trying to feel human, because He's exiled from his country because he's under treason. Depending on which track you listen to, it outright says he left the Air Force, like ran away from it. And there's, you know, dialogue bits where he says, you know, he definitely won't come back. But there's also like something about pornography and just being a lazy pig, which I think were just shots between friends. But yeah, that's that. I like the sort of loungish aspect of that and the loner slant to the character myself.
Yeah. And I think, I think you mentioned this earlier, you know, I mentioned The Wind Rises earlier, but one thing that's very different about this than The Wind Rises is this is a much more playful, fanciful kind of adventure story that skirts around the edges of war and the realities of war, but doesn't directly address them. It definitely addresses the futility of it and the loss that people experience in war. And that's kind of a thing that Porco or Marco, it's going to be hard to say, not say Marco Porco the whole time, but,
pig out of sky.
But the idea of him being a pig, you know, kind of becoming a pig, being cursed, coincides a lot with his loss of faith in his country and in people, and marks a change in him from being a patriot for his country and fighting for his country and the disillusionment of it. And that's a feeling that when you look at the post-World War I period, a lot of soldiers in their memoirs would talk about the futility of the entire conflict. And that's a theme that from the First World War seems to resonate and grow the further we get back from it. And how explicitly Miyazaki is tying the feelings that Porco had to that war in particular or war generally, we don't really know. But the fact that he's a pig is a very specific choice. And I think it sort of alludes to the foulness and dirtiness of being a soldier. And how that really, in becoming a bounty hunter and fighting air pirates, that's really kind of all Porco's life has been reduced to when we encounter him in the beginning of the movie.
Porco Rosso has been said to be the most autobiographical of Miyazaki's films, because Miyazaki, unlike his partner in Ghibli, took to the countryside and sort of left the face of the war and was very sort of, I don't want to say escapist, but definitely turned his head and focused on the beauty of life as opposed to the darkness of war. Whereas Takahata, you know, kind of really just dug down into the trenches and was there experiencing everything and, you know, related it via his art. So what really sort of ties in with that pseudo-escapism is the fact that Porco just loves to fly. And that comes up many a time in the movie. And one of the ways he can manage to eke out a living is just by being a bounty hunter. So it's simply what he has to do. So that's less about war than still being able to enjoy what he enjoys. But like you said, it still has the aspect of war because he is fighting all the time. But it's more a paycheck and a way to earn a living. Thus, I think why it really comes into the aspect that he's a pig. He's still greedy for what he wants to do, despite the toll it takes on others.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that this, again, is set against this backdrop of fascism increasingly gaining power in Italy. You know, we don't really see that in too many direct ways, except through the secret police as antagonists to Porco as he's trying to get his plane rebuilt. And that theme, I think, I'm a bit surprised that he didn't go harder into that, but
I like that it's kind of in there, just sort of this thing that's floating above it.
Yeah.
Like when the chase comes, I think it's like halfway into the movie, three quarters of the way into the movie.
Yeah.
It's like you said, it's very abrupt and it's like, oh, okay, this is suddenly here. but they do sort of lay the lines early on and throughout, and it is very kind of easily excusable and washed over. So it's not as effective as I think it really could be. But when you look back on things, I think if you look at it in retrospect, that they were really just sort of laying this, what was supposed to be an air of fear, or at least risk, and then it culminates in the chase and the fight at the end.
Yeah, it's really, in a way, one of the things that I was thinking about watching the film was the mention of fascism and the presence of the secret police. But when you look at the scenery and the layouts and the backgrounds and the way that 1920s Europe is presented, it's a very, I don't want to say sanitized, it's a very, it's almost idealized, like, you know, if you were going to be a tourist, like this is what you'd expect to see in 1920s Europe. You know, never mind the fact that Europe was absolutely devastated by the First World War, and so, you know, you don't see any signs of that conflict in the movie. You don't see any burned out buildings. You don't see any bullet holes in buildings. You don't see buildings getting rebuilt.
Mm. Yeah, it's all pastoral and it's all lovely.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of that comes from the fact of where this movie came from, which was a three-part manga by Miyazaki called The Age of the Flying Boat. It was all watercolor manga. Mm-hmm. That would explain a lot of the pastoral aspects, I think. But I haven't read the manga, so I'm just, you know, guessing. Yeah.
I mean, glamorous even, if you think about it, with the Gina character, the lovely hotel, bar kind of situation. There's an innocence to this movie that you see in how it's presenting Europe. You see it like right at the beginning. Like, one of my favorite scenes is right at the beginning when he has to go and deal with the Mama Ayuto gang, the sky pirates who rob a boat and take about 15 little schoolgirls hostage. And
they're fucking adorable.
There's little schoolgirls, like, they're so cute. Like, they all just start crawling around and running around in the pirate's plane and are just, like, making themselves right at home and, like, playing with grenades and things. And, like, they're less like schoolgirls and more like little fairies that just, like, you know, make mischief. And, like,
if you want to put it like that, then they're actually gremlins.
Yeah, that's true.
They do kind of bring about the destruction of the plane, so.
Yeah, they help Porco by, like, making the pirate miss shooting him. And but there's this general sense of, oh, you know, we can't separate that. We have to take all 15 of these schoolgirls hostage because we don't want to separate them. That would be mean. And it's like there's this whole innocence to, like, the whole story. You know, and I mean, that's kind of a thing we talk about with Miyazaki, is the feel-good aspect of so many of his films. But I thought that the first part was just super adorable with the little schoolgirls. And when he's trying to figure out which way they went, you know, all of the sailors on the boat making an arrow with their bodies and, like, pointing.
And the undulation.
And the undulation.
Waves, yeah. that was lovely.
It's like, wow, yeah, this is a Miyazaki movie we're watching right here. Holy moly.
my favorite thing from all the schoolgirls were when the plane is sinking, all of them just start, you know, abandoning the seaplane, and the pirates are just going, don't go, you know, either because they're valuable hostages or they're actually legitimately concerned for these small girls in an open ocean. But either way, the little girls go, oh, don't worry, we're in a swim club.
Yeah, like
diving,
like,
off the ship.
The schoolgirls are completely nonplussed by this entire situation. To them, it's like this fun little thing they're doing. They arrive on the pirate ship and, like, there's the big skull, and, like, one of them says, oh, this needs more blood. It's like, you know, like they're just having a good old time, you know, like no worries, no cares at all.
Yeah, your call out over the innocence is, like, dead on right there.
Yeah, I think you really see it. It's really front loaded in the movie, but it sets the tone for what the kind of movie is going to be. Those opening scenes really tell you everything you need to know. You get Porco kind of laying about in his hideout, being super casual. The, you know, picture of a flying ace that's just sort of, you know, a layabout, and he takes the call to go and help, and, you know, he's being really kind of roguish about how he's going to do it. It's like, oh, well, the schoolgirls are going to cost you extra, and, you know. And then he very daringly goes and deals with the pirates, and then he's having to deal with the schoolgirls the same way the pirates were having to deal with the schoolgirls, and they're crawling all over his boat, and, you know, he's trying to fix his engine. And
yeah, but there you get a sort of a more fatherly vibe, because he's, you know, trying to get his plane fixed so he could actually bring them back to where they need to be. But all the playing that's going around the boat, you kind of get the sense that he's, you know, minorly annoyed by it, but also kind of enjoying the joviality of it.
Yeah, yeah. And that whole thing just really does a great job of setting the tone for the whole movie.
So you mentioned the bar earlier, and the bar has an entirely different tone to it. It's the meeting place where all the bounty hunters and air pirates meet up. and it's the place where Porco's old flame owns that particular bar and hotel, and she's also a singer. And something I found kind of astounding was on the G-Kids release, there are three audio tracks. There's Japanese, English, and French. And Gina, who is the owner and proprietor, sings in French. And the voice actress is Tokiko Sato. So it's a Japanese person singing French. And I believe she's Japanese. I'm not actually sure. But her singing is actually used for that singing track on all three dubs. So even the French track kept in Tokiko Sato's song.
Wow. I did not know that. That's really awesome.
But yeah, that bar scene is just so nice and moody. And I miss nightclubs like that. And it was like going back to what you said about like 1920s movies. Mm-hmm. Like that's totally the atmosphere, and they nail it.
Yeah, right down to the smoke and the shining bottles of liquor and the glamour of Gina singing. And in some ways, this reminds me of a Western too. You know, in Western movies, the saloon is always sort of the great meeting hall of where like good guys and bad guys all all gather, you know. And it kind of in the same vein, like you said, you have the bounty hunters like Porco, and then you have the pirate bosses all showing up, and they're all there to recruit the guy who becomes Porco's kind of rival in the film, Donald Curtis, who is like a whole amalgamation of American things.
Actually, he's named after a real airman.
Yeah, he's named after one of the people that helped the Wright brothers like found their initial company, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of, you know, Miyazaki he's very big into planes, and I can certainly appreciate that as someone who also loves planes.
Something to keep an eye out for is actually where Studio Ghibli might have gotten its name. When they're testing a new engine for Porco's plane, the engine headers, I think they're referred to as, have Ghibli stamped on them. And it turns out Ghibli was a producer of parts for planes back in the day. So that might actually be where the studio gets its name from.
Oh, wow. That's neat. I thought they were just like throwing themselves in there. But yeah, the rival guy, Curtis, he really does look a bit like Errol Flynn, actually. He's this really arrogant guy who, you know, is a bit of a womanizer, not unlike Porco Rosso, actually. You know, he wants to become a Hollywood star, and he wants to become the president. So I'm kind of like, where have I seen that before? But, you know, really interesting character in that he's almost like just a textbook rival character. Like, just check every box. You know, he's really good at flying, just like Porco is. He's also highly accomplished, and right away has eyes for Gina, who Porco also has a complex relationship with, where he seems to have feelings for her but doesn't want to act on those feelings.
Then again, Curtis also almost immediately has feelings for Flo too, so you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Do they call her Flo? Because I thought her name was Fio.
Oh, Fio. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, so like Curtis is sort of the reason that Porco kind of goes on this, what ends up being this journey, this character journey for him. Because he has to go get his plane fixed, and that's where he runs into Fio, who is like, where Porco is like super jaded and tired and just world weary. Fio's like this bright eyed 17-year-old, really energetic girl who is also a genius engineer. Her grandfather worked with Porco before, and that's how we get introduced to her. But like, skipping all that stuff to talk about her for a second, she's like the real change agent in the story for Porco, and kind of helps him come to terms a little bit more with the emotions he's grappling with, the grief he's grappling with, the disillusionment, and over the course of the story, you know, he ends up telling her kind of, you know, right around the it's such a neat little three act story this is, but right around the end of your second act, Porco starts telling her about the time when his best friend, I think his name's Bellini, Gina's first husband, he and his squadron was attacked by the enemy, presumably some sort of central power enemy, Germany or Austria-Hungary, somebody from the First World War. And Marco, a.k.a. Porco, his entire squadron's wiped out and until it's just him. And he goes into a cloud to get away, and he ends up blacking out and having, we don't know if it's a dream. He talks about it like it's something that actually happened, but he basically finds himself, you know, above the clouds looking at this silvery band of twinkling kind of lights. And it turns out that he's seeing basically the souls of the dead, including his best friend Bellini, flying up into this river of dead airmen. And that's what it actually is it's just a band of airmen who have all died, you know, thousands and thousands of planes all flying together. And then he blacks out, and he finds himself kind of back in the normal world. And it doesn't come out and like right out say so, but it sort of suggests that that's when Porco starts being Porco and not Marco. Mm. And in telling that story, we actually even see it on camera. We get Marco's true face and not the Porco kind of pig persona that he's adopted, which kind of, you know, tying it back to Flo and what she does for Porco in the story.
You mean Theo?
Do what?
Theo.
Oh, Theo. Yeah.
I've infected you.
Oh, no. Yeah, so tying it back to Theo and what she does in the story, Porco is able to start coming to terms with it because he's able to start talking about it. And she sees his true face on camera just like we do. And it almost makes me kind of wonder if Miyazaki is saying there, his face isn't really a pig face. That's just how he sees himself. And until he can let that go, he can't move on.
It could definitely be that. But knowing Miyazaki, I think there's also an element of the magical there. So I think the exposure to Theo and him actually learning to trust a younger generation and work with them has redeemed him in a sense. So I think that curse would have been lifted because of that. But it's totally plausible that, you know, they pull the old tactic of, oh, it's, you know, just how he sees himself and it's not actually a real thing, but everyone's reacting to him like it was.
Right. And it's entirely, like you said, it's entirely possible that there was some sort of magical event, and that was the magical event, the seeing all the dead airmen that did it. We don't know. There's not a definitive answer one way or another on that. That's probably by design.
Oh yeah, and that's what I really like about the movie.
Yeah, it's my favorite part too.
Yeah, when you can read things multiple ways, it just makes it a lot more fun to think. I wanted to go back to what you said about Curtis, and it hinges on what you said about Theo, because he's not just sort of the typical antagonist or foil, because I really think, like Theo, he has a huge part to play in sort of furthering his distaste for the younger generation initially. Because Curtis is, I believe, supposed to be younger than him. But like you said, just as talented and just as glorified by, you know, his fellow air pirates and bounty hunters and racers and such. But what's really important to know about Curtis's character is he's just all ego and flash and just sort of this horrible nature. And he kind of is what Porco is, so he kind of really hates that. At first, like he's that just greedy and self-concerned, and that's what Porco needs to break out of. So it's really showing sort of this identification with the villain that confirms his own hatred of self, and then by working with Theo and by learning from her or learning of her, sort of that redemption takes place. And I love that triangle of characters.
Yeah, it's a nice interweaving of relationships, and that's another thing we see in this story that is really cool, is just the way that all the, by the end of the story, the way they all the different characters are sort of woven together. And one other hilarious thing that I want to talk about real quick was when they're building the airplane. So Theo designs the airplane, Porco begrudgingly agrees to let her do it, and then they're going to build the plane. And then to build the plane, basically, Mr. Piccolo, Theo's grandfather, the owner of the airplane company, basically calls in every female relation he knows. And we are introduced to like a veritable army of Piccolo women all ready to help build this airplane. And Porco, and this is another kind of nod to the war. You know, Porco, you know, asks, "Don't you have any male relatives?" And Piccolo said, "They're all either looking for work or we're in the war." You know, another kind of oof in an otherwise really lighthearted scene.
Something along the lines to that nod is, it's just a little bit of storytelling that I thought was one of the most masterful bits in the entire movie. It was Gina's initial conversation with Porco in the upstairs room of the hotel. I think they're just having Porco's having dinner and wine, and she comes to sit with him, and she relays an anecdote about a pickup attempt where the ending of the story is about the deaths of all her former husbands. And she says, you know, one was lost in Europe and one was lost here and the other one was lost in Asia. And Porco replies, "Oh, so you finally found out about the third." Now, we don't know any history between these two characters up until that point. So that little story and his response instantly gives you a lot of what you need to know about the two. They're intimate enough to talk about, you know, the former husbands who all died as pilots. It relays the intimacy of their relationship and how long they've known each other. It's so good.
And it's a very adult conversation to have in the middle of what's up until that point been a very lighthearted, kid-focused romp, you know? Because that's like that conversation happens right after Porco lands, after he's gotten the schoolgirls from the beginning of the movie back to safety, and he's beaten the Mama Ayuto gang. And then you have the shift, and it really, I agree with you, it was really well done. And that's something I just feel like you see just kind of all through this movie is that it feels like a movie that really can appeal on multiple levels to different age groups. And the more serious talk about the loss of, you know, Gina's husbands in conflicts and war really underscores that. And really at that point in the movie begins to underscore it for the first time in a way that we, you know, don't see in the introduction.
Hmm. Anything else you want to comment on?
I'm trying to, I think.
Oh, actually, I've got one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That shift in tone might be owed to, again, what this is based on. And I mentioned before, it's a watercolor manga called The Age of the Flying Boat. And that was actually commissioned by Japan Airlines, I think, as sort of like this light in-flight entertainment thing. Again, I'm not sure about the content of the manga, but I know it was originally supposed to be just something for in-flight entertainment. And then war broke out in Yugoslavia, and Miyazaki went, "Oh, hold on. This can no longer be that thing."
Yeah.
So he churned a greater depth of story into it. And it's not like his later works where it's ham-fisted. It's very well spliced together. All like Jared said, everything kind of flows very nicely, and it's all due to the how intricately some of the hints are woven into conversation and visual cues.
Yeah, I had actually seen The Wind Rises before I saw Porco Rosso, so the contrast between the two was inevitable to me. And I think one of the main things where Wind Rises falls down, where this doesn't, is it's important that art have a message, but there's a point where you can force the message, I think, too much, and then it kind of overwhelms the work you're trying to make, and it feels, you know, ham-fisted, like you said. And you know, it was
don't
really
go hogging all my puns, Jerry.
God. I'm surprised that's all the ones we've had. I thought you were going to go hog wild. But anyway, yeah, this to me is a much more, I think, effective way to really look at the pain that war leaves after the shooting stops. Because that's when you look at the character of Marco
Porco,
that's really what he's grappling with, is just the how to move on and how to recover and how to live after both killing so many people and losing so many people in a war. But it was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, for the for the message it has, it's a very fun and humorous watch almost all the way through. Like, there are a couple of scenes where things get a little intimate and little heavy, but nothing that's really treated with a huge amount of weight.
Yeah.
Or I should say depicted with a huge amount of weight.
I will note that the dub for this, there's a Disney dub that happened for this a while back, and I think that's the one that we still have today. Porco is voiced by Michael Keaton.
And he's amazing.
Yes, that Michael Keaton. And Donald Curtis is voiced by Cary Elwes, who is also amazing. And it's a great cast. Like, everybody does a great job. But those two, like, really, really, really...
ham it up.
Ham it up. There you go. There you go. Anything else? I feel like we didn't really talk about Fio that much, but, you know, like, I feel like we got to the important parts.
Yeah, I mean, we got to her essential character. She's awesome. I love how energetic she is. The voice actor who plays her in both the Japanese and English dubs knocks it out of the park. Youthful enthusiasm and brimming and wanting to prove herself, and totally does on all fronts. And it's not like she's totally faultless. Like, she does kind of shoot her mouth off a couple times and manage to dig Porco in a little deeper than he wants to be, but it ends up being what he needs to be. So, you know, she's a fun character. She's great. She's kind of one of my favorite archetypes in Miyazaki movies.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Like, she comes off to me very much as young female protagonist in Miyazaki film.
Yeah.
and I don't mean that with any disrespect. She's great in the film, but she sort of seems like, Leiji Matsumoto. You know, he always has, like, the same character. like Princess Esmeralda is, like, it feels like she's in everything because the character design is so ubiquitous in everything he does, even though I know that's not true. Please don't at me. Send your hate mail to evan@anygamers.com, you know, et cetera. But Miyazaki, too, I think, has that same thing. Like, young teenage girls all kind of look samey to me, with the exception of maybe Kiki. Now I'm out of things to say.
I just want to remark on one, two things. One is, I don't know if it was an influence for how he portrayed dogfights, but Hell's Angels was a film by Howard Hughes, and it was a notoriously delayed production because of so many things, but mostly because he was shooting, I think, in a desert at the time, because it was better for the planes. Unfortunately, there was no, like, rain clouds or clouds at all during the production, so he noticed that when the planes were all up in the air and flying, it didn't really look like much because it was just this blank palette of blue, and so you didn't really get how fast the planes were going or how sharp the turns were. And so they basically waited it out for, I forgot how long, but until the clouds finally came and they could have that shot showing relative distance and speed and all that. And there are two points in this movie, in Porco Rosso, where there are multitudinous planes up in the air in dogfights, and Miyazaki always makes sure to have, in one shot, there's a very large boat in the water and a cloud while you see these planes swarming. And the other one's shot up in the sky, and there are two clouds at varying levels, so you could see sort of the plane's interactions with them. So he's very careful to have something static to show off the dynamic movements of the planes. And being a fellow aviation enthusiast, I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah, the dogfights are really good in this, as is, like, just the sense of speed and motion you get when you're seeing the planes. There's a shot that I really like about when they're first testing the new and improved, I don't know that his plane has a name, but the red plane that Porco Rosso flies.
I believe it's a fictitious one.
You know, they finally get it. You know, they're, like, driving it through the canal, trying not to run over anybody. And they finally get it in the air. And then there's this couple of seconds of landscape just flying under you, like, really quickly. And then, and then you're over the sea. And, man, I loved that so much. It was so evocative of what that feels like, you know, to be in a plane like that.
I will say, I'll disagree with you on one thing. The dogfights were you know, there's not really a whole lot of focus on the dogfights. They are certainly in there at a lot of points, but they're over quickly, and they're not really the focus of the film. The focus is definitely more on the characters. But, and you can at me on this, there is a wonderful show whose plot sucks and whose story sucks, but the dogfighting is like 1,000 times superior to this movie. And it's called The Magnificent Kotobuki. And if you love watching airplanes fly, watch that. Because the tales behind the design of that and how they engineered the planes and had them move, they had an aerial engineer applying dynamics of weight and yaw and spin and everything to make sure that the planes looked like they were flying like planes. And my God, you feel every turn in that thing. It is so good.
I will agree with you on that. Magnificent Kotobuki is good. I need to finish watching it, but you have urged me to watch that quite often, and it is actually quite good, I think.
One of the things I do with the dogfights really well in this is, again, show that contrast between Porco and Curtis in regards to old school versus new school. Because when Porco initially gets sort of ambushed by Curtis, he's having engine troubles. And it used to be, at least this is the story, in World War I, there was actually this sort of code of honor amongst pilots, because they used to fly what was called flying coffins, because you get hit with a bullet and basically you're done for. So it was seen as this fool's errand, basically, pilot. But during dogfights, if a gun would jam, a pilot would stick their hand out the side of the plane towards the other pilot who they were fighting and make a motion of a gun with their finger and just pull the trigger, meaning, I can't shoot. And supposedly, the other person who was dogfighting with them would break apart and just let them return back. And in Porco Rosso, despite the engine jamming and Porco yelling that out to Curtis continues his attack and tears apart the only thing that Porco really loves. And I thought that was a really nice way to instill character.
Ooh, yeah. That's a really interesting thought. And it's a really interesting way to establish, you know, Curtis as a credible threat. You know, up until that point, he was just, you know, a lot of talk and suave looking with his little mustache. And, you know, that really shows us, okay, no, like this is someone to take seriously.
That wraps it up for me. How about you?
I think I'm good. I think it's time to tell people where they can find us.
Jared, where can they find you on the internet if they choose to do so?
Find me on Twitter, at Jalane Nelson. I am somewhat active on there, but if you say hi, I will say hi back.
You can find me at Animated Inc. on the Tweety Box. And over at Taiku Podcast as their official bad sports anime correspondent. Back issues of Otaku USA Magazine and Fandom Post. And, of course, you can go to anigamers.com for show notes and blog posts. And you can post comments there and we'll try to get back to you as well. You can also interact with Evan, myself, David, Jared, and Anaki, as well as everyone else in the Animagamers Discord via the Animagamers Discord. And if you feel the compulsion, we do have a Patreon. You can support us on there, and there's various levels. You can get priority question privileges, as well as access to bonus articles and podcasts, including our mini-series, Old Taku in Space, which is actually just wrapping up, or soon will be, and Anaki and David's Animagamers Book Club, which is kind of novel in the fact that it reviews light novels. So you can listen to our podcasts. Thank you. Both the Anigamers podcast proper and Old Talking No Radio can be heard via iTunes, Stitcher, Google Music, and Spotify. Leave a couple of reviews. It'll help more people find the shows that we produce, and hopefully they would find some shows they love.
All right. Well, that's all for this episode. For Inc., for myself, appreciate you listening, and we'll see you next time.
Toodles.